Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for mostly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Some clouds start to roll in for tonight with overnight lows in the upper 40s. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 64, up to 66 on Thursday, 69 by Friday. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 63 degrees at KJZZ. The Tucson City Council is meeting behind closed doors this afternoon to determine its next steps in a potential showdown with the state. A new state law allows Arizona's Attorney General to investigate whether cities and towns are violating existing state laws, and AG Mark Brnovich has determined Tucson may be in violation of one. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block is following this in Tucson today. And Jude, what is the law the city may be violating, and how might it be in violation?
Yeah, this came about because a representative from Oro Valley filed a complaint under this new mechanism that we now have, thanks to this bill passed by the state legislature called SB 1487. And Fincham's complaint was that there are state laws on the books that specify how to handle firearms and explicitly say that they are not supposed to be destroyed. It seems like the intent of that law was that there shouldn't be like gun buyback programs where cities buy back guns and then destroy them. But meanwhile, Tucson has a long-standing policy and a city ordinance dating back to 2005 to destroy guns that are certain guns that they wind up with that are sort of in their possession, that are abandoned or from crime scenes, and with the idea that why circulate these guns only to encounter them later. This is the conflict at play. Representative Fincham filed this complaint basically saying that Tucson's policy of destroying guns rather than reselling them is in violation of state law.
So it seems like Tucson has a few different potential options, right? What kinds of things is the council deciding on what to do right now?
So yeah, so they have the option of basically changing their ordinance and no longer destroying these firearms. But they also have the option of fighting it out in court. It's an expensive option, though, because we're at the very beginning of how this will work under this new mechanism. But there is something in that legislation that lays out how the city, when it defends itself in court, has to put up a bond representing, you know, a certain amount of money. And in Tucson's case, this would be, according to the city attorney, $50 million to fight their case. And there's also the possibility that the city attorney's position here in Tucson is that this law that came out of SB 1487 is unconstitutional, and perhaps they will take action to challenge this very mechanism that is being used to challenge their city ordinance, so a countersuit.
Jude, do you know if Tucson officials have been in contact with officials in other cities or towns across the state which are also potentially facing investigations due to this new mechanism in SB 1487?
Yeah, I talked to the Tucson city attorney this morning, and he said that cities have been in touch even before SB 1487 became law because they knew that this would impact them all. Currently, right now, there's only two active investigations from the attorney general responding to complaints under SB 1487. There's this Tucson gun destruction issue, but there's also an issue pending in Snowflake regarding a medical marijuana facility. But there's also these longstanding conflicts that we've seen in other cities. Bisbee, for example, passed a policy banning plastic bags. And then we saw the state legislature pass a law banning plastic bag bans. And we've seen issues having to do with not allowing cities to tax Airbnb rentals. I mean, so this has been a brewing fight that we've seen kind of really heating up in the last couple of years in Arizona, this tension between cities wanting to pass certain policies and the state legislature effectively preempting them.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block in Tucson. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
Phoenix Police Chief Jerry Williams is moving 169 officers to patrol duty. It's an effort to make up for a shortage in that area. The head of one police union has called the situation a staffing crisis. For more on what the move means and what kind of impact it may have on officers and the public, I'm joined by Sean Mattson, president of the Phoenix Police Sergeants and Lieutenants Association. And Sean, what do you make of Chief Williams' decision to reassign a number of officers to patrol?
Well, I think first it's important to understand the why we're here. And one of the reasons why we're here is because back in, I think it was 2007, we were at our largest manpower size in Phoenix Police Department's history. And when we had so many officers that were available, we were able to create all these little bells and whistles details that had maybe overlapping missions or very narrow scope missions. And then over time, and you know, the financial collapse in 2008, we've depleted so much that we still have those bells and whistles details that we're trying to staff. And it's hard to do that without draining from patrol. So the new chief has determined that, you know, our core function is to put bodies back into the street. And in doing so, you're going to have to drain from those bells and whistles details.
Well, in your mind, is this the best and maybe most efficient way to deal with that issue? I mean, are there other things that you think the department could be doing to get more officers on the streets?
Well, you know, there's always several things that you can do. But the two biggest things to do is either the physical body or pay for the overtime. And our overtime bill has gone astronomical. But what's more important than that is the fatigue it's caused on personnel that have been pulling 16-hour days, 6 days a week, trying to keep the staffing levels on the street up there.
The city's been talking for a little while now about trying to hire more officers, get back to some of the staffing levels of before the Great Recession. Do you get the sense that that's happening at an appropriate pace?
Well, that's a delicate balance. It'd be great to hire 600 people overnight to get us back to where our staffing was. That'd be awesome. The problem is that comes with that is the fact that you end up not getting the cream of the crop that successfully tests to become officers. And then when you don't get the cream of the crop, that's when you start seeing, you know, some of that residual misconduct issues down the road. Hiring in a rush is dangerous, and I would not support that because I want to make sure that we have the best of the best responding to those calls to service.
It sounds like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that your take on all of this is that this is not an ideal situation. It's not necessarily a situation that you love, but given the reality and given the current circumstances of where the Phoenix Police Department is, it's something that is necessary to do. Is that a fair assessment of how you think about this?
And that, sir, is why you talk for a living and I don't. That is well said. I think that it's going to frustrate a lot of folks. Change is never met with a warm embrace. And so especially the folks this is going to be impacting, you know, citizens and employees alike. Hopefully services aren't diminished that much. They just won't be as specialized as they were before.
For the officers that will be shifting to patrol beats, are there particular skills that maybe they had when they were doing that originally that maybe have, you know, atrophied over time or gone out of practice by not using them? I mean, are the officers sort of equipped to be doing what they will be asked to do now?
Well, that's a good point. You know, I know that when I went back to the street after serving a few years in Homeland Defense Bureau, technology changed. And that's true today. I think that the processes don't really change. It's the technologies that support those processes that change. But the other side of that coin is that they're taking their experiences to the street, where that's pretty much the young side of our force. So they're going to be gaining, you know, detectives and folks that are specialized in investigating specific crimes out riding alongside them. So with the learning curve that needs to happen with technologies, you're also going to get the experience, you know, with the having worked in specialized details for so long.
What are you hearing from your members? What are you hearing from some of the officers who are going to be affected by this?
I think you get two different responses. I think that if you ask anybody, you know, the honest question, does something like this need to happen? I think if they were to give you an honest reply, they would say yes. But what ends up happening is folks that are specifically impacted as an individual it's a don't move my cheese scenario. I mean, they don't want their world to change at all. They think the change needs to happen, just not specifically to them. I think what's more concerning is the civilians' take on it. And the citizenry have relied heavily on maybe a specific detail that's not going to happen. They're going to have to rely on patrol officers that they don't have those relationships with. I think that's a larger concern that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be explained to the citizens that this is a temporary fix right now, and we have to do it because our core focus is responding and investigating calls to service.
Sean Mattson is president of the Phoenix Police Sergeants and Lieutenants Association. We talked about Phoenix Police hiring more officers. City Manager Ed Zerker says the agency is working on it.
The department is in full hiring mode, and we are up. We're at 2,866 officers, which is over 125 officers more than we had about 18 months ago. So that's good news. We're on a path to get to 3,100 plus officers, but it's going to take us a while to get there within our resources.
Zerker says making sure the city's patrol beats are fully staffed is an important goal and the essence of Chief Williams' move, but he understands the concerns about moving officers around.
Certainly, when people are not doing what they used to do before, that's going to be missed. But I think the main point is that the fundamental mission of the police department is the patrol function and responding to the community's calls for service and being out there and visible in the community.
Phoenix City Manager Ed Zerker on Police Chief Jerry Williams' decision to move 169 officers to patrol duty.
City officials and local advocates met today for a ceremonial groundbreaking of a special housing project for autistic adults in downtown Phoenix. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn was there and spoke with leaders of the movement to bring inclusive housing to the city. And Casey, where does this project come from?
So this project comes from a group called First Place AZ, and that was founded by Denise Resnick, who has a 25-year-old son with autism. It's actually a sister nonprofit to the Autism Research Center she also helped found. But First Place concentrates only on this housing, which is near 3rd Street and Thomas Road. And that's really for anyone with special needs who wants to live independently. Here's Resnick.
The looming question for parents like me of a child with autism or special needs is who's going to care for him when I'm no longer able to do so. And we want people to have more hope.
And she thinks the inclusive housing will give a lot of parents like her peace of mind.
So First Place Phoenix is more than just apartments, though, right? What else comes along with the property?
Right. So there are 56 different apartments that will be up for lease, and each is going to be supported by independent living services and staff to help the residents. There's also what's called a transition academy. That's a 2-year program meant to give any special needs adults the skills you and I might sometimes take for granted that gives us a more independent life. Those are things like getting ready for a career, navigating public transportation, and just how to interact in day-to-day life. And finally, there's also a plan to create a training center for service providers and professionals, and that's all going to be on this 81,000-square-foot property.
And the housing is geared towards someone on the autism spectrum, but anyone with special needs can apply, right? So who is there today, and what was their response to the groundbreaking?
And actually, yeah, today there were a lot of families who came out to see the site for this new housing, and many of them had their own family members with special needs, and it was actually really emotional, too. A group of adults with special needs did help ceremonially break ground with city leaders like Mayor Greg Stanton and Arizona's Department of Housing Director. 22-year-old John Kemp was part of that group, and he says the housing not only creates a welcoming environment, but also gives him a voice.
I mean, I have autism, and I would like to let the world know that I will make a change in the world.
And Kemp plans to live in the housing once it's completed in 2018.
That was KJZZ's Casey Kuhn speaking about a new housing development being built for adults with autism and special needs that broke ground today in Phoenix. Thanks, Casey.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody. Are the police on your side or not? And if they are, how can we evaluate their actions? We can now peer through the window of newly available web cameras and auto dash cams to see what happens at the time of a police shooting. There's also the window of history, the fears we carry, the aggressions we cling to.
A mistrial was declared yesterday in the police shooting death of Walter Scott, whose shooting and subsequent death was captured on both cell phone and dash camera footage as he ran from an officer. following a traffic stop for a non-working taillight. Michael Slager, a white North Charleston police officer, is seen shooting Scott, who is African-American, firing multiple rounds from behind while pursuing him. Slager testified in the trial that he was in total fear of his life. Jurors were dismissed over the weekend, with all but one juror believing Slager was guilty. Deliberations continued most of the day Monday before the judge declared a mistrial. The panel's only black member, the jury's foreman, said there was just one juror with issues. Phil Stinson is a former police officer and currently an associate professor of criminology at Bowling Green State University's criminal justice program, where he collects data on police-related shootings. A jury, he says, is also an imperfect window for seeing how a community applies its standards in cases like these.
When I looked at this video, the first time I saw this video of this shooting, I was really shocked, frankly, because what we have there is Walter Scott running away from the officer, and with his back to the officer shoots him dead. It was an execution. It was not justified, in my opinion. And then, even more shocking, the officer's very first reaction, the very first thing he did was to run back and get his taser, which was about 60 feet away on the ground, and place it next to the fallen man's body. In other words, he planted evidence. And we've known for a long time that some dirty cops plant evidence, that that happens, but we've never seen it on video before. And it's really troubling, and it's a view into the police subculture that the general public doesn't often see.
Well, that's what's so puzzling about this case. I mean, I'm looking through that window just like you are. I'm shocked just like you are. I'm feeling as though my safety as a citizen is compromised by the idea that someone who in one moment says, I'm fearing for my life, and the next moment is like covering up evidence, right, that it's all a bunch of baloney. Why did they walk free? Why did they walk free?
Well, you know, I ask myself this question every day, and one of the things that I keep coming back to, I wonder if frankly they're overcharging the officers. In other words, it would be a lot easier to prove negligence if they had just gone with that, if they had gone with a lesser degree of homicide, so a manslaughter charge from the beginning. Another thing they could do is there's a charge, it's an odd name, but it's called felony murder, and that's when someone commits a killing during the act of some felony. And we've seen that specifically in the state of Georgia. They seem to use that more often in these police shooting cases, and it's resulted in getting convictions more often than not. And so it's a tough thing, but the prosecutor has to, in any case, make sure that they can prove the elements of the crime or crimes that they charge. And we're seeing it over and over again. They're just not going to be able to make murder cases out in the most egregious of situations, the most shocking of situations, as we have here in the video we all saw with Michael Slager.
Does the prosecution have a choice of whether to retry this or not?
Oh, absolutely. And they are going to retry it. But more importantly than that, you know, there are some other avenues that can be taken and are being taken in this case. So there are statutes that are federal criminal deprivation of civil rights laws, so 18 U.S.C. 242. And under that, historically, what that's been used for is when a state has failed to prosecute or failed to successfully prosecute a police officer, they come in after that and try an officer. And that's what we saw in the Rodney King case, for example, many years ago with Stacey Kuhn and the other police officers out there in Los Angeles. And it was successful, that prosecution, whereas the state had not been as successful before that. So Slager is facing a federal trial for criminal deprivation of civil rights and some firearms charges coming up. And I think there's a better chance that he'll be convicted at that trial. And then the prosecutor has to make a decision. Are they going to retry Slager? And if so, what charges? And they've already said, yes, they're going to retry Slager. But that's not always the case in this type of situation. We've seen it in a few instances recently, one in North Carolina just a few weeks ago, where the decision was made initially not to charge an officer. And we've seen it over and over again, where once there's been an unsuccessful prosecution, the state declines to re-prosecute the case. They don't try it again. They just figure they're not going to be able to get a conviction. So I think it's important that we've got the federal charges pending. It's a little bit odd that the feds got out in front here and their case is ready to go to trial pretty soon now. Usually they wait until the state's failed to successfully prosecute. But I think that's a good thing, and that's exactly why that law's there.
Phil, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Philip Stinson is associate professor at Bowling Green State University's criminal justice program.
And that's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
There are nearly 600,000 open IT jobs across the country, and they're not just in the tech industry.
IT companies that work specifically in the IT area, but also healthcare, insurance, all these other companies, manufacturing, that utilize IT people in their businesses, can't find enough people that have the level of skill and years of working in that area to have the broad knowledge.
Rosalind Boxer is the Vice President of Workforce Development at the Arizona Office of Economic Opportunity, and her office just signed Arizona onto a White House program aimed at filling those open IT jobs.
Believe me, there isn't a single company that doesn't have a need for somebody who has good IT skills. And so if you are that person who has those skills, you have a job. That's important.
Arizona just became one of 70 cities, states, and rural areas to join the Tech Hire Initiative, which aims to build a pipeline of tech talent that can give people a pathway into the middle class. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with Boxer more about this, and Lauren joins me. So how many IT jobs are open here in Arizona?
So as of today, Boxer told me there are more than 6,200 jobs open in the IT field here in Arizona. So to address that, the Office of Economic Opportunity is working with the Arizona Tech Council and some other groups like that on this Tech Hires Initiative. They're aiming to develop a boot camp for people who are interested in IT and need the skills and certifications they need to get hired. And their goal is to get 100 people into IT jobs in the first year of the program and 500 people in the next 4 years. They're already running a small pilot program to test this out now. It's a 2-week boot camp for training, and then they're placed with a company for a paid apprenticeship. And when I spoke to Rosalind Boxer about this, I asked her more about this idea of an apprenticeship. And she said, while it seems pretty old-fashioned, it's an important part of job training today.
Apprenticeship is a very old system, but it is now being retooled to meet the needs of the new industry areas and the new occupations. So we want to put people into IT apprenticeship programs because an apprenticeship program is you get the job and you learn it as you work and you get paid accordingly. So it's a great way for a company who likes somebody and wants to hire them to watch how they learn and watch how they do the work over that period of time and train them exactly the way they want them to do it. It's really a very, very useful tool.
Okay. So how do you find people to do these? Are these people who are laid off from manufacturing jobs and need to be retrained?
We work with other organizations like the Tech Council, like Maricopa Workforce Connection, like Maricopa Community College to say, how can we fill the pipeline with people who you know are interested and have the skills for the IT occupations. And then we also look at the companies that we work with and see if we can match them up.
You talked about numbers and how many people you want to get placed and things like that. But overall, looking at the economy and like how our economy is changing so much, why do you think this kind of training is important right now?
These jobs are the jobs of the future, quite honestly. They are the jobs that anybody in any one of the industries that we want to grow here and are growing here. If you have the inclination for IT, this is the perfect time to get yourself certified and to contact your workforce area and see how you can participate in this. I really see that the future of our economy is not only about how you bring companies in or grow companies, but in order to be successful, you have to have the good workforce to man those companies. And that's what IT is, part of that workforce.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that so much of this work is like a public-private partnership.
It has to be a public-private partnership. You can't do this alone. One of the things that I learned over the many years that I've been doing workforce and working with companies is that a company doesn't do it alone. Government doesn't do it alone. You have to have all the partners together and for all of them to consider what this means, not only to them, but then to the growth of the state itself and the community that they're in.
That was Rosalind Boxer, Vice President of Workforce Development at the Arizona Office of Economic Opportunity, talking about the White House's Tech Hire Initiative that's about to start here in Arizona.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
After nearly 24 years as Maricopa County Sheriff, Joe Arpaio has less than a month left in office. KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block has this report about Arpaio's departure from the post that made him a national figure.
No one in Maricopa County history has been sheriff longer than Joe Arpaio.
It's tough leaving this office after 24 years, working 14 hours a day.
After winning six terms, he lost last month to former Phoenix Police Sergeant Paul Penzone by almost 13 points. At a recent press conference, Arpaio told reporters his wife Ava was disappointed.
She feels somewhat sad that I didn't win, but that's the way it is. The voters have spoken, and life continues.
After taking office in 1993, Arpaio first became nationally known for Tent City, pink underwear, and chain gangs. Later, he was both celebrated and hated all over the country for his crackdown on illegal immigration. There were also scandals, misspending, uninvestigated sex crimes, baseless investigations into political rivals, and a judge's finding that his office racially profiled Latinos. And that lawsuit has cost taxpayers close to $50 million so far. One major change for Arpaio is that when he leaves office, he'll lose his security detail, which has been watching over him for the past 8 years as a result of threats against him.
Can't go out of my house without these guys. So now I'll be able to go out of my house on my own and do my thing and hope I stay alive. But I'm willing to take that risk.
Looming ahead for Arpaio is a federal criminal contempt of court trial in April. Justice Department lawyers are prosecuting him for ignoring a judge's orders to halt his immigration patrols. But Arpaio also still has a national fan base all over the country, and he hints he doesn't plan to disappear from public life.
Maybe a private citizen, maybe. But a private citizen is a very powerful rank to have. Think of that. So I'm known around the world. I'm sure some people are going to remember this sheriff.
The sheriff was one of President-elect Donald Trump's earliest and most loyal supporters. He jokes he correctly predicted Trump's victory even when he forecast his own race wrong. There's been some speculation over whether Arpaio could get some kind of appointment in the Trump administration. Arpaio wouldn't say how he'd respond if he got an offer, but he did say it would be tough to turn Trump down.
Because of who he is and how he's treated me and my family. I'm not giving you an answer. I'm just saying how it would be more difficult for me to make up my mind.
For the last 10 years, Bill Crawford has volunteered in Arpaio's posse, which he says was an honor and a privilege. He says he admires Arpaio's philosophy and leadership.
He was very strict, and if you did something wrong, you were going to pay a consequence for it, and you were going to go to jail. But while you were in jail, he took very good care of people, and he made it punitive so that they didn't want to come back. But while they were in there, he had programs to rehabilitate them.
Meanwhile, many of the sheriff's critics see Arpaio's departure as a positive change for the county. That includes county officials and judges who were investigated by Arpaio and in some cases indicted by former county attorney Andy Thomas on allegations of corruption that were later found to be baseless. Among them is outgoing supervisor Andy Kanasik. He says he believes Arpaio was motivated by politics when he pursued these investigations, which he says is an unforgivable offense for someone in law enforcement.
I think that a lot of people were targeted because they wouldn't play ball or wouldn't do exactly what the sheriff wanted. And that's third world dictatorship. That is not America. And for that, I say good riddance.
Arpaio still has at least one major press conference left before he departs office in the new year. He's expected to reveal new details about his investigation into President Barack Obama's birth certificate. As Arpaio's most recent press conference drew to a close, he seemed a bit wistful these appearances would be ending soon for good.
Thank you for coming out, and gonna miss you.
Paul Penzone will be sworn in as the new Maricopa County Sheriff on January 4th. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In a check of KJZZ News at 2:37, the Tucson City Council has just voted to challenge Senate Bill 1487. As KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block reported at the top of the program, the City Council met this afternoon to decide whether or not to challenge the new state law. The statute punishes cities if the state attorney general finds a state law is being violated. Under the measure, the failure of a city, town, or county to comply would require the state treasurer to stop providing state aid and redistribute those dollars to every other community. The Tucson city attorney told KJZZ the city is challenging the constitutionality of that law. In a check now of international news, the Chinese government and the Catholic Church are believed to be close to an historic agreement governing the ordination of bishops. In recent years, China's 10 million Catholics have been allowed to worship publicly again, but many choose to worship in underground churches with bishops chosen by the Vatican, not the state. And some worry a deal will mean less religious freedom, not more. The BBC's Kerry Gracie reports.
Every pew and every aisle in Beijing's South Cathedral is full. Generation to generation, China's Catholics have held on to their faith despite decades of persecution. Nowadays, they have more freedom to worship, but the state still keeps a close watch on their allegiance to the Pope.
The Pope is excellent. We all love him. I think it would be the best if he can work without the influence of the Chinese government, so he can lead us directly.
So why is the Chinese government involved at all?
The problem of China is that since 2,000 years in China, the emperor was emperor and pope at the same time. He decided upon all matters, also matters of religion. This applies also to communist China.
Father Jerome Hendricks has spent 60 years trying to help the Catholic Church in China. He says the problem comes down to the clash of a proud and mighty state with a proud and ancient church.
Through the history of the Catholic Church in China, there has not been much dialogue, many misunderstandings, confrontation. And we have not seen this in 70 years. Both sides have changed. And this is what constitutes a new opportunity for this dialogue to succeed.
In a village courtyard far from Beijing, a very different Catholic service. No magnificent cathedral here. Instead, farmers huddled under an open sky, and through pollution haze and tangled power lines, a sinking sun lighting their bowed heads. Despite the freezing temperatures and the fear of police harassment, there are far more worshippers in this yard than in the local government church. Their priest is Dong Guanghua, a 58-year-old local laborer. He's not just against the government's role in religion. He's against any Vatican deal with the government. And after declaring himself a bishop in defiance of church and state, both now regard him as an outlaw.
I respect the Pope, but I don't support this. The agreement will hurt us. The church will be harmed because this hardline government will not bend. Sometimes the government gives rewards to people who yield. I don't covet those rewards. I'm not afraid because my conscience is clear.
Even senior voices in the Catholic hierarchy are uneasy about what a deal with Beijing may cost the church. Joseph Zen is the retired cardinal of Hong Kong.
No agreement is better than a bad agreement. The Chinese government, they have already very much in control. They don't need to compromise. What they want is a complete surrender.
That's the BBC's Kerry Gracie. In order to solve a scientific problem or come up with the answer to a question, scientists from different disciplines sometimes have to work together. But even though they're all using words many non-scientists don't understand, a completely common language has proven elusive. Now researchers are talking about this. Ariel Anbar is one of them. He's a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at ASU and co-author of a paper about this, which was published in the journal Nature. And Ariel, how big of an issue is this?
It's a huge issue. So the challenge is that many of the problems that really interest us and that are really important to society are problems and challenges that fall in the intersections between the traditional disciplines. And so you need to bring in researchers from different areas who have not traditionally worked with each other to try to address those issues. And it turns out that researchers in their communities develop their own language and sets of assumptions and so on that are distinct to those communities and make it hard to talk to other communities.
Are you talking about just like different acronyms, or are we talking about literally different ways of saying the same thing?
Sometimes it's different ways of saying the same thing. Sometimes it's actually the opposite. Sometimes it's using the same word with different meanings in the two communities. And so you'll have a conversation where the two parties think they know what they're talking about, but it turns out they actually had different notions of what they meant.
Is there good science or good data that are being lost because of this language barrier?
Almost certainly. It's hard to quantify. It's hard to know what's being lost because it's stuff that isn't there yet, right? But it's the ideas that aren't discovered, the solutions that aren't developed because people aren't having the kind of rich conversations that they need to have in order to spark the ideas. That's what tends to get lost. So it's hard to know exactly how much is getting lost, but we know we're not realizing the full potential.
Do you think the answer is a common language, or is this sort of a case-by-case basis where you sort of, when you start a project, you sort of set the ground rules for how people are going to refer to things?
It's case-by-case, and you can't really do it at the beginning. You can't set ground rules necessarily at the beginning, because at the beginning, nobody really knows where those difficult points are, because these are almost always conversations that never happened before, right? And so that's why you're getting the room together in the first place, because it's an unsolved problem, and hey, we realize we need to get this community and that community together, and then you're fumbling around, and you know, it may take a while before you even realize that, oh, there's this issue. So what we've started doing is we started actually collaborating with scholars of communication. These are people coming out of the humanities and social sciences who have developed fairly simple and straightforward but effective techniques for figuring out where the common understanding is and where it's missing. You know, fairly simple things like language surveys, vocabulary surveys, and then analyzing the results of those in various ways. So that's something we've sort of stumbled into as a valuable tool to diagnose, right, to figure out where the rough spots are.
Are there certain scientific disciplines for which this is more of a problem than others, have you found?
Well, what we've found, which I think is very interesting, is that when the disciplines are closer together initially, what you find is that the problem is worse. So if you get a bunch of people together who are geologists, they presume they have a shared base of knowledge that they actually don't. When you get biologists and astronomers together, there's no presumption that there's a shared base of knowledge. And so they right away engage in asking all the dumb questions, quote unquote dumb questions, that get people learning really fast. It's interesting when you think about it that scientists among themselves have as big a challenge in communication as the general public has in trying to understand what scientists are talking about, right? I mean, so what we've been talking about the scientist-scientist communication, but there's also the scientist-general public communication. And people in the general public often tend to think that, oh, well, you know, the scientists know all this stuff, and of course they can talk to each other, right? But we're the dumb ones, we don't understand. But the reality is, no, the public's not dumb. It's just the general public hasn't learned the vocabulary and these concepts. But then when you talk about getting scientists from different communities in the room together, they're just as quote-unquote dumb about what each other does as a non-scientist is about science. So, one of the challenges to overcome when getting a bunch of academics in the room together across disciplines is for them to let go of this notion that they're experts and be willing to say, hey, you know, I don't know. I don't know this stuff. I'm kind of stupid about this. And that's one of the big challenges.
How optimistic are you that this kind of divide will ultimately bridge on a more universal basis?
I'm very optimistic because we do it all the time. I mean, the progress of science is very much a story of these bridges being built. And so we know we can do it. What's happening now is we have better and better awareness that this is an issue, and we have better and better tools and approaches for addressing it. And so I'm actually quite optimistic about it.
Ariel Anbar is a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at ASU and co-author of a paper about helping scientists in different disciplines communicate with each other, which was published in the journal Nature. Jazz improvisation often happens in dark clubs or rehearsal spaces, not in computer labs. KJZZ's Naomi Gingold, though, joins me to talk about how that might be changing.
Hi, Mark. I spoke with Dr. Clayton Morrison. He's a professor at the University of Arizona, and his team is currently working on making computers that create and improvise jazz. The program is called Musica. But the thing is, his program, it's under DARPA. And some people might be familiar with DARPA as the government agency that basically created the internet.
Yeah, it's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Exactly, and it's a part of the U.S. Department of Defense.
So why exactly is the government funding computers creating jazz?
Well, I'll let Dr. Clayton explain that. I started out with the basics. What is your lab doing?
We're building an artificial intelligence agent that will do real-time jazz improvisation. That's the application, but the real underlying goal is to better understand how humans naturally interact with each other and how we would like to be able to interact with computers in such a way that the computer can be an equal participant in some sort of collaborative composition that involves creativity. Our specific application is jazz improvisation, but in the past year, our project has expanded to not just be about jazz improvisation in real time, but also communicating with natural language so that we would actually carry on a conversation with Musica, saying things like, oh, please give me a melody that's in C major. And then the human will react to that, you know, say, oh, you know, that's nice, but I don't like this part.
So where are we? I mean, it seems like these two really huge parts. I mean, it's all artificial intelligence, but where are we?
Where are we at? The current state is that we're able to read this music, a lot of these jazz standards. We're able to generate some single line melodies that are played over an implicit chord progression. So if we provide the chord progression, it can generate a single line melody. And we're definitely working on trying to expand that to, you know, polyphonic.
So can Musica interact with the musician and like trade fours as they do in jazz?
Very, very simplistically. It makes mistakes, and that's actually important. We expect it to make mistakes, and those are going to be the places where we understand where we need to try to improve Musica. We're in the process of training it to hopefully get incrementally better. This is Musica playing jazz, maybe as a first year, sixth grade jazz musician.
Why is the U.S. Defense Department interested in a computer learning how to improvise jazz?
Right. No, that's a very good question. This comes back again to the overall vision of the program that we're a part of, which is communicating with computers. The goal is to be getting computers to be able to interact more naturally with people. What I think is unique about jazz and about music generally is that it requires paying attention to things that are not necessarily well scripted, while at the same time there's structure. So kind of basically strategic kinds of thinking that we're trying to capture and better understand. And so the code that we're writing and the kinds of algorithms we're developing, even though they're about music, are more generally about figuring out very quickly what to pay attention to and what not to pay attention to, and to come up with a plan for how am I going to respond and carry forward a conversation. And most importantly, to try to understand what the other person's expressing and add to it.
To some degree, people might say that computers already interact with humans.
I think very badly. They can only do exactly what they're told, and they do very little of actually adding to the conversation. The goal would be to have a machine learning system that's able to introspect and explain itself, to say, here's why I made this decision. Now, we're seeking technology where computers can become equal participants in the conversation. Now, this is all in that neighborhood of trying to get our technology so that we can communicate with it better, and so that, in a sense, it can understand itself better and communicate back.
Isn't that a little bit scary? If they can really think and become a completely equal participant?
Yeah, well, we as humans have decisions we need to make about where we want computers to play a role in our life and what kind of control we want computers to have over our lives. But there's an enormous gulf between us and how we communicate with each other and how we understand what it is computers are doing and how we interact with them. The vision here is computers as collaborators rather than impenetrable black boxes that we don't understand. You know, eventually we are going to get to the point where these machines are complex enough that we're going to have to be very careful about the moral systems that we embed in them. And likewise, be very careful about the control that we cede to them. You know, ultimately, humans were the ones deciding what it is we're wanting the machine to participate with us to work towards.
And that was U of A Professor Clayton Morrison speaking with KJZZ's Naomi Gingell. Thanks, Naomi.
Thanks, Mark.
Bookstores across the country took a pretty sizable hit over the past few years from online sellers like Amazon. But there are signs that small independent bookstores are starting to turn the page. And a new Phoenix shop is jumping into the market, catering to both English and Spanish readers. Rosie Magana owns Palabras Libraria on Grand Avenue, just west of downtown. The space also serves as a community library for residents who can't afford to buy books. Most of her titles come from donations. Sitting by the front window of her store, I asked her what need she saw that she wanted to fill.
I saw that there is a very large Hispanic population in Phoenix that was not being served. When you look at most bookstores, you see maybe one small shelf somewhere in a corner, and that's about it for Spanish books. And just my own personal experience growing up as a first-generation Mexican-American, there just wasn't a lot available.
Is that a problem that is unique to Phoenix? I mean, I think of other cities that have foreign language bookstores. Is that just something that we don't have here?
I don't think it's something that's unique to Phoenix, because part of the inspiration for the bookstore was a traveling installation called Libreria Donceles. And it is basically trying to make a statement of all these major cities that have lots of Spanish speakers but do not have a Spanish bookstore.
What is the importance of having a dedicated Spanish-English bookstore?
It's going to bring communities together. Communities that don't necessarily always feel like they're part of the community. And I think that's really a huge part of the motivation behind the bookstore, is bringing people together, realizing the similarities between cultures instead of differences, and also helping people acquire the English language. In order to do that, they need to utilize Spanish because it is a first language, and giving people more opportunities that they didn't necessarily have before through language.
Do you feel that the libraries in Phoenix and in the Valley do an adequate job of providing foreign language and Spanish language books?
I think the Phoenix Public Library tends to have a lot more titles than even I knew existed. I'd only gone recently to see what they had. But sometimes it's still difficult to go to a public library. Sometimes it's out of the way, especially if you don't have a mode of transportation, which in a lot of cases, specifically this neighborhood in Grand, you're far in walking distance terms from the light rail, so it's still kind of a trek for you to go. It's nice to have something in your own neighborhood.
Who's your target audience here? I mean, who are your ideal customers?
My target audience is a combination of people. So for a lot of the workshops and programs that we're going to have, that we've already started, it has to do with trying to get people in the community that don't necessarily have a lot of resources, and trying to help them in any way we can through language and literacy. And then there's also the other people in the community that maybe do have all those resources and just want to be a part of something, or are trying to learn Spanish because it's a good skill to have. It's the second most spoken language in this country. So trying to bridge a gap there so that, you know, people can, from different walks of life, can come together and develop a sense of community in Phoenix that's all-inclusive.
Rosie Magana owns Palabras Libraria in Phoenix. The addition of an English-Spanish bookstore is also good news for Maggie Messerschmidt. She's an editor with Cardboard House Press, a bilingual publishing house dedicated to innovative works of Latin American and Spanish language literature.
We recognize that there is a huge gap, you know, between a Spanish-speaking public and the availability of literature in Spanish and from Latin American writers. And so we work on getting that material available in the United States literary market, and then also creating avenues of access to that literature.
How much of what you're trying to do is introduce readers to authors who are already out there who maybe they just don't have access to otherwise? And how much of it is trying to find new authors yourselves?
For the most part, I think it's the former. We're interested in recognizing the value of some fantastic Latin American writers, Spanish language writers, because we don't want to exclude Spain in this. So the idea is, you know, in a school, even if you are studying Latin American literature, you're likely to be exposed to just a few writers like Octavio Paz and Pablo Neruda, and that's who everybody knows. But the point for me, especially as, you know, as American, like I read so much literature from Victorian literature, literature from the United States, and was not exposed to literature from around the world and the richness of that. And so intellectualism is not a one-way street where it's, you know, the English language that dominates. There's really important ideas out there that are coming from all corners of the earth. And so I think it is, you know, a statement to say, let's open up the spectrum a little bit wider and see what else is out there.
Do you find that your audience is English-speaking, Spanish-speaking, bilingual? Like who are you trying to reach here?
Both. I think, you know, our first probably most enthusiastic audience has been like universities, actually. And then the bilingual literary kind of world, we found a lot of interest from that world. And then I think recently we've really found students. We've worked in Bloomington in Indiana University, and there were some young students that were really looking for some identity around, not just around literature, but just biculturalism. And then here in Phoenix, you know, Palabras has opened kind of a new spectrum of an audience where, yeah, I think that there's a lot of kind of second or third or even fourth generation Mexican Americans that are looking for interesting things to read.
Maggie Messerschmidt is an editor with Cardboard House Press based in Phoenix and Indiana. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.